Thank you, and a great big howdy, and welcome to our show to each and every one of you. I know you'll be proud that you have joined us today, because we have got, I think, one of the greatest country music artists of our time, a very special friend of mine, I'm happy to say, and we're delighted to have him on our show. Let's make him welcome the one and only Merle Haggard and the Strangers.
RadioResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and news for our people, and of course those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, what do we have here? Apparently, a couple of days ago, Governor Newsom of the radical Democratic governor of California announced that he had a huge moral objection to the death penalty. It fell disproportionately on what's euphemistically called people of color or African Americans. They may be Africans, but anyway, and so on and so on and so on. I think there were over 700 people on death row in California. And with all the appeals and so on, it takes forever to actually get them executed. And I think there's actually been, in effect, a de facto ban for the last 10 years. So but there'll be no more death penalty executions in California with Governor Newsom, so at least not until the voters, if they, in their wisdom, seek to get rid of him. I have to think, what totally politically correct garbage. I, too, of course, worry about a person being wrongfully convicted. I think that's valid. Nonetheless, people will die, people will be murdered, and their killers will be caught, in some cases, will be duly convicted, will be sentenced to death, but there will be no execution. All because the governor cannot face the moral trauma of executing a murderous villain or putting down a mad dog. And of course the excuses. Well, the death penalty falls disproportionately on Negroes. Okay, why is that? You mean if you if you jaywalk and you're white, you get a fine. If you jaywalk and you're a Negro, you get executed? No. Okay, well, why would you be executed? Well, committing a capital offense, almost invariably murder. And usually it has to be a pretty horrific murder. See, well, it just so happens that this is a case where figures don't lie, but liars figure. It's true. More disproportionately, Negroes are on death row. They're about 33% of death row. They're about, give or take, about 11% of the U.S. population. So they represent three times their proportion of the United States. Why might that be? Well, this isn't a tough one. Because they commit crimes wildly out of proportion to their share of the population. That's the reason. No big mystery here. This is something, you know, I think we have to constantly fight back against. You know, because that statistic will be put out there with the clear implication that somehow it's wrong. It's wrong that blacks should be executed out of the, disproportionate number to their share of the population. Really, what ought to be asked is, why is it that blacks commit crime out of all proportion to their share of the population? Well, there are reasons. Hate to say it, but somewhat lower IQ, and in terms of behavioral inclinations, lower self-restraint, and being prone to violence. Now, that doesn't mean that they're condemned to do this. It doesn't mean that they have no option. It just means that their inclinations are in that direction. So you mix stupid, low self-restraint, and tendency to violence, and you have the type of people who tend to commit more crime than people who are perhaps a little bit more prone to look at the consequences of their action, a little less inclined to stoop to violence as their first alternative, and who are a little bit more intelligent. Intelligent people generally tend to anticipate the future, or think about the future, or think about the consequences of their actions. And having dealt with a fair number of people who've been in prison, I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in prison are stupid, are low intelligence. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been caught, would they? Low intelligence, and in some cases, mentally ill. Living out or living with their own demons. And that's not to have compassion on some of the people in prison. I've known people who are in prison who do not deserve to be in prison. And I know people in prison for violating laws that are bad laws. But as a generality, the people in prison tend to be not very bright. And so you look at the not very bright part of your population. There are not a lot of whites with 110 IQs in prison. But there are many whites with low IQs and many blacks with low IQs in prison, as blacks tend to be lower on the IQ scale than whites in the United States, an IQ of about roughly 85. Whites have an IQ of roughly 100, Now, I mean, and now according to Dr. Sanchez, I've dropped to 98. This is not surprising. I think we have to talk about these things. Because a lot of this is important to refute the nonsense that is hurled at us. Okay, well, it would be hard to have turned on a television or a radio and not heard that yesterday in New Zealand, an Australian named Brenton Tarrant, allegedly, and I have to underline this, allegedly, visited two mosques and killed 49 people and wounded 48 more. And this was all in Christchurch. And this is a news item. It says, a white supremacist. There, of course, is a defamation. And we'll try to get to his ideas in a moment, because I'd rather hear what he has to say before I slap a label on him. An example of the text reveals an obsession with historical figures who fought against the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic superpower of its day, and the Rotherham sex abuse scandal. He has covered up by key elements of the British establishment in their city, police, social workers, and many others. This was the recruitment, the grooming, and the abuse through giving them drugs, alcohol, and beatings of hundreds of young white girls in their middle teens over a decade. So that Rotherham really has a, it should really be a rallying cry for us, for what is so desperately wrong with our system. Now, I would like to read the manifesto, and I want to be very careful about this. Very careful in the sense I want to make it quite clear. I, the Canadian Association for Free Expression, the Canada First Immigration Reform Committee, the Council of Conservative Citizens, none of the groups or organizations with which I work supports violence. Well, okay, supports other than defense of violence. We're not pacifists. I do not believe in using violence as a political weapon. I want to make that very, very clear. I also want to emphasize that for over 30 years, and in advocacy before numerous government commissions and tribunals and so on, I have on many occasions warned, when you silence the men of the pen, you will have to deal with the men of the sword. Now, most Western nations, including Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and not officially the United States, but with only those exceptions, almost all Western European nations, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa, have brought in, over the last 40 or 50 years, some form of anti-hate legislation. In other words, criminalizing criticism of privileged minorities. Now, of course, there are defenses. In some places, the laws are stricter than others. In some cases, they've even graduated to outright bans on questioning the Hollywood version of World War II. In fact, they've really become laws to enforce a religion. Just as certain Islamic countries forbid blasphemy, in other words, they enforce their religion by law, in certain Western countries, it is illegal to question the new religion of Holocaust. In Germany, to say, I don't believe the so-called Holocaust happened, or I don't think 6 million died, or something along those lines, can land you in jail. Not just theoretically, it has. 10 months in prison for Monica Schaefer for a little 6-minute video she did some years ago, about back in 2016, Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust. 3 years and 2 months for her brother Alfred Schaefer for a number of videos he's done questioning the Holocaust. People go to jail for expressing the nonviolent expression of their political views in Canada. And we fought many of these battles. Brad Love, the voice of the working man, the citizen's journalist, was convicted back early in, I think in 2002, for writing to about 20 politicians letters very critical of immigration. I want to make it quite clear, these were not threatening letters. These are not letters that happen to make a political comment, but in fact threatened to rearrange the person's face. No, nothing like that. The nonviolent expression of his political views. Arthur Topham, who had a website, radicalpress.com, made a lot of critical comments about organized Jewish religion, about the Zionist threat to freedoms, about the psychotic threat in a 1941 book that advocated the genocide of Germany. The book was entitled Germany Must Perish. Well, he did a parody. He rewrote the first couple of chapters and entitled it the same style on the cover, but put Israel Must Perish. He got a 6-month suspended sentence with a number of parole conditions for that. And so it goes. And then under a law that is now being repealed, but that was the Canadian Human Rights Act as it applied to the Internet, Section 13, dozens of people faced lifetime bans from publishing material that was likely to expose to hatred or contempt privileged groups, basically, mostly Jews. When a Saskatchewan Human Rights Act that said roughly the same thing went all the way to the Supreme Court in 2012, the Supreme Court came down with a verdict that was a hoof to the testicles of freedom of speech in Canada. It stated that basically because there are a majority hateful comments about Christians would not really be actionable. And even though talking about the threat of the LGBT agenda, of pushing homosexuality, etc., in the schools, even though that was, first of all, a sincerely held religious view of a man by the name of Bill Watcott, even though it was also at least partially a political statement, none of that mattered, and truth was no defense. Now, in criminal cases, truth is a defense, but in these human rights cases, truth was not considered a defense. It didn't matter if what he said was true. It was the impact. It was whether or not the hatred or contempt might be, or the privileged groups might be exposed to hatred or contempt. So we have seen the steady erosion of freedom of speech in Canada and across the Western world, including the United States. Pressure on some of the Silicon Valley institutions, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, PayPal, and other means like this to shut down controversial speech. But it's always on our side of the fence. You know, it's really white nationalist or whatever. So there has been a concerted attempt, much of it agitated for by the Jewish lobby, but not only them, to curtail discussion and to shut down debate across the West in some countries, worse than others. And what I said, and I really stand by this, and it's a warning. It's not a threat. But when you silence the man of the pen, you must then deal with the man of the sword. Because let's say, take the case of Brad Love. If you're going to face 18 months in jail for writing letters protesting immigration to a member of parliament, well, why not? Okay, I won't spell it out, but if you're going to be thrown in jail for expressing your opinion peacefully in writing, perhaps some will decide that it's better to express themselves more forcefully in violent means. And I won't take it any further than that, but I think you get my message. All of this is by way of an introduction to the manifesto published, and I'm hoping many people will copy this because there will be efforts to suppress it. I like to go to the original source. Like, what did this alleged gunman say? And this is the manifesto of the man who is alleged to have killed the 49 people in two mosques in Christchurch, Australia. And it's entitled The Great Replacement. I'm going to say from the beginning, I don't want to be leaving any doubt about my opinion. I think this man's analysis is basically correct. This is what's happening to us. This is not the course I've chosen, and certainly not the course I would urge others to choose. I think we must fight this nonviolently. But I do understand, with what's being done to us, the efforts to silence us and marginalize us in many, many ways, this sort of thing is absolutely predictable. I'd like to just conclude that that in Canada, it's not just the prohibition of saying certain things with the so-called anti-free speech laws, but it's also efforts to marginalize certain opinions so they don't get heard. For instance, Justin Trudeau, he's our trust fund kid, Prime Minister King, won the 2015 election, and one of his promises was we would replace our first-past-the-post electoral system with proportion, some form of proportional representation. Well, that got muddled, mucked around for a bit, and finally, after about a year and a half, that was abandoned. Now, it was abandoned for several reasons, but one of those reasons was that the former Premier of British Columbia, a Sikh by the name of Ujjal Dosanjh, who later became a Liberal, and others convinced Trudeau that if he had some form of proportional representation, and what that means is that as nearly as possible, the seating in the House of Commons would reflect the percentage of the vote. So theoretically, let's say a populist party was not strong enough in any one particular riding to elect a member, but did, say, pull, say, 5% of the vote in Canada across the country, they would get 5% of the House of Commons, which would be, give or take, about 18 members. There are different forms of proportional representation, but anyway, the fear of even electing one populist or nationalist was enough to cause Trudeau to retreat from that promise. That's how much they fear the public expression of these ideas, because I think they know how bankrupt their own policies are. Anyway, I'm going to read most of the manifesto. Here's the manifesto of the alleged shooter in the killings of so far 49 persons at two Christchurch mosques. It's entitled The Great Replacement, in reference to the mass invasion of white societies by non-whites that is set to racially and culturally replace our societies if continued at present rates. He starts off by quoting a poem, and I think it's actually the words are quite moving. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave it at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. The wise men at their end know dark is right. Because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. I'm not going to read the rest of the poem because I think it is fairly thick, but certainly do not go gentle into that good night. It's the birth rates. If there's one thing I want you to remember from these writings, is that the birth rates must change. Even if we were to deport all non-Europeans from our lands tomorrow, the European people would still be spiraling into decay and eventual death. Every day we become fewer in number. We grow older, we become weaker. In the end, we must return to replacement fertility levels or it will kill us. To maintain a population, the people must achieve a birth rate that reaches replacement fertility levels. In the Western world, this is roughly 2.06 women births per woman of childbearing age. There's not a single Western country, not a single white nation, that reaches these levels. Not in Europe, not in the Americas, not in Australia or New Zealand. White people are failing to reproduce, failing to create families, failing to have children. But despite this sub-replacement fertility level, the population of the West is increasing and rapidly. How is this possible? Mass immigration and the higher fertility rates of the immigrants themselves are causing this increase in population. We are experiencing an invasion on a level never before seen in history. Millions of people pouring across our borders legally, invited by the state and corporate entities to replace the white people who fail to reproduce, fail to create the cheap labor, new consumers, and tax base that the corporations and the states need to survive. The crisis of mass immigration and sub-replacement fertility is an assault on the European people that, if not combated, will ultimately result in the complete racial and cultural replacement of the European peoples. To see this in full effect, you only have to look at the population statistics in Western nations for the year 2100. All through immigration, this is ethnic replacement, this is cultural replacement, this is racial replacement, this is white genocide. To return to the replacement fertility levels is priority number one, but it's no simple task. There are myriad reasons behind the decline in fertility rates and the destruction of the traditional family unit. We must inevitably correct the disaster of hedonistic, nihilistic individualism, but it will take some time, time we do not have due to the crisis of mass immigration. Due to mass immigration, we lack the time scale required to enact the civilizational paradigm shift we need to undertake to return to health and prosperity. Mass immigration will disenfranchise us, subvert our nations, destroy our communities, destroy our ethnic bonds, destroy our cultures, destroy our peoples. Long before low fertility levels ever could, before we deal with the fertility rates, we must deal with both the invaders within our lands and the invaders that seek to enter our lands. We must crush immigration and deport those invaders already living on our soil. It's not just a matter of prosperity, but the very survival of our people. Answering possible questions. In general, who are you? Just an ordinary white man, 28 years old, born in Australia to a working class, low income family. My parents are Scottish, Irish, and English stock. I had a regular childhood without any great issues. I had little interest in education during my schooling, barely achieving a passing grade. I did not attend university as I had no great interest in anything offered at the universities to study. I worked for a short time before making some money investing in BitConnect is what he says, then use the money from the investment to travel. More recently, I've been working part-time as a kebab removalist. I'm just a regular white man from a regular family. Who decided to take a stand to ensure a future for my people? Why did you carry out the attack? To most of all, show the invaders that our lands will never be their lands. Our homelands are our own, and that as long as white men still live, as long as a white man still lives, they will never conquer our lands and they will never replace our people. To take revenge on the invaders for the hundreds of thousands of deaths caused by foreign invaders in European lands throughout history. To take revenge for the enslavement of millions of Europeans taken from their lands by the Islamic slavers. To take revenge for the thousands of European lives lost to terror attacks through European lands. To take revenge for Ebba Åkerlund. To directly reduce immigration rates to European lands by intimidating and physically removing the invaders themselves. To agitate the political enemies of my people into action. To cause them to overextend their own end and experience the eventual and inevitable backlash as a result. To incite violence, retaliation, and further divide between the European people and the invaders currently occupying European soil. To avenge those European men and women lost in the constant and never-ending wars of European history, who died for their lands, died for their peoples, only to have their lands given away to any foreign scum that bothered to show up, to agitate the political enemies of my people into action, to show the effect of direct action, lighting a path forward for those that wish to follow, a path for those that wish to free their ancestors' land from the invaders' grasp, and to be a beacon for those that wish to create a lasting culture to tell them that they are not alone, to create an atmosphere of fear and change in which drastic, powerful, and revolutionary action can occur, to add momentum to the pendulum swings of history, further destabilizing and polarizing Western society in order to eventually destroy the current nihilistic, hedonistic, individualistic insanity that has taken control of Western thought, to drive a wedge between the nations of NATO that are European and the Turks that make part of the European NATO forces, thereby turning NATO once more into a united European army and pushing Turkey once more back into the true position of a foreign enemy force. Finally, to create conflict between the two ideologies within the United States on the ownership of firearms in order to further social, cultural, political, and racial divide within the United States. This conflict over the Second Amendment and the attempted removal of firearms rights will ultimately result in a civil war that will eventually balkanize the United States along political, cultural, and more importantly, racial lines. The balkanization of the U.S. will not only result in the racial separation of the people within the United States, ensuring the future of the white race on the North American continent, but also ensuring the death of the melting pot pipe dream. I'll skip ahead. What do you want? Well, we must ensure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Was there a particular event or reason you decided to commit a violent attack? There was a period of time 2 years ago, 2 years prior to the attack, that dramatically changed my views. The period of time was from the beginning of April 2017 until the end of May 2017. In this time period, a series of events broke down my own reserves, my reservations, my cynicism, and revealed the truth of the West's current situation. These events turned my thoughts from pursuing a democratic political solution and finally caused the revelation of the truth that a violent revolutionary solution is the only possible solution to the current crisis. And then this is all from the manifesto of the alleged perpetrator of the attack on two mosques yesterday in Christchurch in New Zealand. And as I say, I read this not because I agree with the action. I do not. Because I think his underlying analysis of what our problem is correct. This as a solution, I'll just be quite clear, emphatically, I do not agree with violence. But, I have to say this, I understand the anger and the frustration of people who have simply been silenced for all too long. And these are the this is what happened that changed his mind. I was traveling as a tourist in Western Europe at the time, France, Spain, Portugal, and other countries. The first event that began the change was the terror attack in Stockholm on April 7th, 2017. It was another terror attack in the seemingly never-ending attacks that have been occurring on a regular basis throughout my adult life. But for some reason, this was different. The jaded cynicism with which I greeted previous attacks didn't eventuate. Something that had been part of my life for as long as I could remember, cynicism in the face of the attacks on the West by Islamic invaders, was suddenly no longer there. I could no longer bring the sneer on my face. I could no longer turn my back on the violence. Something this time was different. The difference was Ebba Åkerlund. Young, innocent, and dead Ebba. She was walking to meet her mother after school when she was murdered by an Islamic attacker, driving a stolen vehicle through the shopping promenade on which she was walking. Ebba was partially deaf, unable to hear the attacker coming. Ebba's death at the hands of the invaders, the indignity of her violent demise, and my inability to stop it broke through my own jaded cynicism like a sledgehammer. I could no longer ignore the attacks. They were attacks on my people, attacks on my culture, attacks on my faith, and attacks on my soul. They would not be ignored. The second was the 2017 French general election. The candidates were an obvious sign of our times. A globalist, capitalist, egalitarian, an ex-investment banker who had no national beliefs other than the pursuit of profit, versus a milquetoast, feckless, civic nationalist, an uncontroversial figure whose most brave and inspired idea resolved to the possible deportation of illegal immigrants. Despite this ridiculous matchup, the possibility that he's obviously very critical of Marine Le Pen, despite this ridiculous matchup, the possibility of a victory by the quasi-nationalists was at least, to myself, a sign that maybe a political solution was still possible. The internationalist, globalist, anti-white ex-banker won. It wasn't even close, he's referring to Emmanuel Macron, the now present president of France. The truth of the political situation in Europe was suddenly impossible to accept. My despair set in. My belief in a democratic solution soon vanished. The final push was the witnessing the state of French cities and towns. For many years, I had been hearing and reading of the invasion of France by non-whites. Many of these rumors and stories I believed to be exaggerations, created to push a political narrative. But once I arrived in France, I found the stories to be not only true, but profoundly understated. In every French city, in every French town, the invaders were there. No matter where I traveled, no matter how small or rural the community I visited, the invaders were there. The French people were often in a minority themselves, and the French that were in the streets were often alone, childless, or of advanced age, whilst the immigrants were young, energized, and with large families and many children. I remember pulling into a shopping center, a car park, to buy groceries in some moderate-sized town in eastern France of roughly 15,000 to 25,000 people. As I sat there in the parking lot in my rental car, I watched a stream of the invaders walk through the shopping center's front doors. For every French man or woman, there's double the number of invaders. I'd seen enough, and in anger drove out of the town, refusing to stay any longer in the cursed place, and headed on to the next town. Driving toward the next French town on my itinerary, knowing that inevitably the invaders would also be there, I found my emotions swinging between fuming rage and suffocating despair at the indignity of the invasion of France, the pessimism of the French people, the loss of culture and identity, and the farce of the political solutions offered. I came upon a cemetery, one of the many mass cemeteries created to bury the French and other European soldiers lost in the wars that crippled Europe. I had seen many pictures and heard many people discuss the cemeteries, but even knowing about these cemeteries in advance, I was still not prepared for the sight. Simple white wooden crosses stretching from the fields beside the roadway, seemingly without end to the horizon, their numbers uncountable, the representation of their loss unfathomable. I pulled my rental car over and sat, staring at the crosses and contemplating how it was that despite these men and women's sacrifice, despite their bravery, we had still fallen so far. I broke into tears, sobbing alone in the car, staring at the crosses at the forgotten dead. Why were we allowing these soldiers' deaths to be in vain? Why were we allowing the invaders to conquer us, overcome us, without a single shot fired in response? In front of those endless crosses, in front of those dead soldiers, lost in forgotten wars, my despair turned to shame, my shame to guilt, my guilt to anger, and my anger to rage. Why won't somebody do something? Why won't somebody do something? Why don't I do something? The spell broke. Why don't I do something? Why not me? If not me, then who? Why then, when I could do it myself? It was there that I decided to do something. It was there I decided to take action, to commit to force, to commit to violence, to take the fight to the invaders myself. And the question, whom do you represent? Millions of European and other ethno-nationalist people who wish to live in peace amongst their own people, living in their own lands, practicing their own traditions, and deciding the future of their own kind. Are you a part of any political groups or movements? I'm not a direct member of any organization or group, though I've donated to many nationalist groups and have interacted with many more. Did the groups you support or align to promote your attack? No. No group ordered my attack. I made the decision myself, though I did contact the Reborn Knights Templar for a blessing of support on the attack, which was given. Anyway, there's more to the manifesto, but I think that's when the question is asked, well, why did he do it? And I think that is the answer. As I say, there is more to it. But I'll be glad if you want it, if you cannot find it on the internet, to send it on to you. If you just email me at paul@paulfromm.com. I want to make it quite clear. I believe his analysis of what the problem is correct. I do not agree with his solution. I still believe in peaceful protest, peaceful organizing, and so on. And this is not speaking out of two sides of my mouth at once, but it was inevitable. When you silence the man of the pen, you will have to deal with the man of the sword. This was coming. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Going to take my musical break right now. I'm trying to find out why I cannot find it. we do, especially traveling, we do seem to have our problems with the internet at times. But you're very, very patient, and just bear with me for a second, and I think we'll get this resolved. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'll play some more country and western tonight. I like Carl Jackson. This is good bluegrass music, and this is the Little Mountain Church. Hope you like it. It's. Yeah.
There's a little mountain church in my thoughts of yesterday, where friends and family gathered for the Lord. There an old-fashioned preacher taught the straight and narrow way for what few coins a congregation could afford. Dressed in all our Sunday best, we sat on pews of solid oak, and I remember how our voices filled the air. How Mama sounded like an angel on those high soprano notes. So when the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. All day Sunday singings and
dinner on the ground. Many were the souls that were revived, while the brothers and the sisters who'd gone on to glory land slept in peace in the maple grove nearby. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon.
Another one with Carl Jackson, Ashley Campbell, and Larry Cordell. Hope you like it. This is more bluegrass and bluegrass gospel. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
Carl, why are you putting your guitar down?
To do a little test, Ashley.
Ah, what test is that, Carl?
Nice of you to ask. Well, you know, if I pick up another banjo, let's see what happens.
Band of banjos.
Nobody left yet, right? Don't let anybody out, Louie.
Dude, it's crowd tonight, Carl.
Thank you. it's my request.
That's Carl Jackson and Ashley Campbell. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And here's another singer from that kind of group of bluegrass music. And her name is Sierra Hull. Hope you like her songs or song. And this is... this is called Mad River Jordan. This is an old gospel song. Sierra Hull and River Jordan. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And we do have, it is a little slow with the internet here. Enjoy. Ask to your understanding. This has to be called up.
To the river of Jordan, our Savior went one day, and we read that John the Baptist met him there. When John baptized Jesus in Jordan's rushing water, the mighty power of God filled the air. I'm on my way
to the river of Jordan.
Gonna wait right
in the rushing water.
I'm going down.
I'm going down to the river of Jordan. And let the cool waters cleanse my soul.
River Jordan. I'm going to conclude the musical break here with another song by Sierra Hull with Courtney Hartman, and this is called Where the Soul of Man Never Dies. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. This is Sierra Hull and Courtney Hartman, Where the Soul of Man Never Dies. Which will be upon us.
Well, for you musicians out there, last night I said, I think it's in C, but you can't, it's in C. And we kicked it off, and I sing tenor on most of this stuff. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I was up in the clouds last night.
I'm trying to get this sound up a little bit so we can hear it.
So we hope this is a little lower than where the band's in our show. The class ring strikes again. My apologies. Let's try it again.
From here on the Fighting Side, we'll be back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign up tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. And back with you again tomorrow. Hopefully we will get this few bars of the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.